Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And the topic today is, what's the weirdest stuff you ever had to cook?
Oh, well, that's funny.
We have a few other things to talk
because
about.
Because Luke just asked me, our producer just asked me, what is the weirdest thing I've ever grilled? And I said, I've never grilled anything weird. And he said, come on, really? I'm like, well, no, I can't. All right.
I put some seaweed on the grill one time.
Ooh.
Yeah, just to get a little bit smoky. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Just to dry it a little bit, get a little bit smoky. And,
well, that's pretty weird.
Yeah. It was great.
But not so weird, really.
Yeah, no, it was helping at a place with putting lunch together in Sardinia to do grill eels, like whole eels on the grill.
Nice.
And that was one of the dishes on the side.
That's a good side.
So there.
that's a good side.
So there. if you're Sardinian, that's not that weird.
I was going to say grilled eel might be a little weird for a lot of American people.
I thought that the grilled seaweed was kind of that.
Yeah, that's out there.
But
good,
it was
job,
good.
Tony.
It was good. So what's the weirdest stuff you've ever had to cook? I can think of one thing that should be on your list because you completely freaked out when you had to cook it. But I'll see if you get there
on
your own.
The thing that made me the most upset that I ever cooked is turtle.
I knew it. That was the
one. Oh, my gosh. That was our first James Beard Foundation dinner. And we were asked.
I can still see those turtles walking around in your office.
It was awful. It was awful. And then I had Lee, who had worked for me for years, she had worked
Sensitive
in
soul.
D.C. Oh, yeah. Super wonderful young woman, and she and I were both a mess. I mean, and she was much worse than me. She was in there feeding them. I'm like, no.
They're supposed
that's
to
like
be
torture.
They're supposed to be in there starving, basically, before you kill them, you know?
It was awful. Well, the thing is that we were doing, it was when we had Savannah and the Admiral fell in, and we had just, you know, that was when we first came to Baltimore, or for you coming back,
I want to make it clear, this is 22 years ago, and we don't condone the murder of turtles.
Yeah, right? No, not at all. And
nor does WIPR, lest we get in deep trouble.
Right. So the Beard Foundation, I was all excited because the Beard Foundation asked me to do my first beard dinner. And I'm like, oh, my God. And back then, it was such an honor. And, you know, not too many. I mean, the Beard House wasn't that old then. I mean,
it's still an honor, but there was a dinner once or twice
that.
A week.
Right.
Most of the year, not all of the year. There's
right.
not
every
an
night.
Event every single night.
Right. And I was asked to do a dinner. You know, there were a group of us. They asked Michael
three
Gettier.
Maryland chefs.
Yeah, three Maryland chefs. Four. Michael Gettier, Nancy Longo, and
Linwood
and me, yeah. And then they had asked us to do obviously a Maryland dinner since we were Maryland chefs. So I was talking to my sous chef Tim Walker, and he grew up here. And I was talking to you obviously as well. You grew up here, and I said, you know, what's really traditional? Because you know, I had just moved here. I didn't know that much about the tradition of Maryland cooking, and then you guys started talking about turtle soup.
The
and
most
I'm like,
traditional
okay, there
thing?
Is no
turtle soup.
Way that I am killing turtles. And I looked
There's
at Tim
reason.
Walker
University
and
of Maryland
said,
is the Maryland terrapins, you know.
Sure. No, I understand. Well, I mean, any
We're
old
in turtle
southern,
country.
Any old, pardon me, Maryland cookbook has like 8 recipes for turtle soup, or terrapin stew, or whatever. And so I looked at Tim and I said, there's absolutely no way I'm doing anything to those turtles. You know, I knew we had to do more than one course, and I knew once the stock was made that I could make the soup. But he was like, oh, no problem. I'm like, oh, it just totally freaked me out. I was very upset by that.
Tim was upset by that. He was trying really hard not to show it, but.
Do you think he was?
Yeah, he was.
I didn't know that.
I mean,
well,
Tim,
I can't believe anybody.
Tim was
the
larger than life guy who was about 350 pounds. And,
yeah.
And, but yeah, he was.
Well,
not,
I'm glad
he
to hear that. I didn't realize. Actually, I didn't realize that because he made it sound
that.
Like it was no big deal for him to do that.
He did. He had no problem enjoying the soup, but he did not
right.
enjoy that.
Right. Yeah. So, but yeah, that's probably the most difficult thing I've ever done, or thought to do. Actually, I didn't actually do it. He did. But, you know, I've always wanted to work with things like sea urchin and you know just to explore them, but I've never done it. You know, we've served it at some of our other properties. Other chefs have worked with it, but it's just not been a big interest of mine. And so that sort of excludes those sorts of unusual things. To me, those would be sea urchin or eel, certainly would be, you know, because when you get the eel in, it has to be alive. And then you there's a process to dealing with that.
Yeah, in Sardinia, those guys, they used a sword, essentially, to spear that eel.
Okay.
To hold it over the fire.
Okay.
You have to stand and hold the darn thing on the on the sword over the fire.
Yeah. I mean, the first time we skewered lobsters I'm like, you have to kill them first. That's just all there is to it, which you just drive a knife through their head and pull it through the front. This is the murder program,
yeah, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, well, it kind of is. Oh, my God.
When you go to download the podcast, it'll be the murder program.
Well, we've already talked about how to clean soft shells, so I don't have to go into that one.
I just started with seaweed to be nice,
Seaweed honestly,
is gentle. Everybody
I'm
likes
not
it.
A big weird cooking person, so I mean I like
well,
things
we,
that
maybe we should hear from listeners what is the weirdest stuff you've ever had to cook.
Yes,
so email us foremanwolf@wypr.org.
I would love to hear
and
what people
tell
say
us.
Yes,
we'll read your great responses on the air. Mm-hmm. All of the weirdest stuff that you've had to cook or wanted to cook or did cook, or it seems like whenever we have a call-in show and someone calls based on their experience in Pakistan or something, There's some wild story that they have, or dish from some remote place. It's always cool to hear.
I remember when I was a little girl. I've said many times my parents are from York, Pennsylvania. My mother is a very traditional Pennsylvania Dutch cook, and my grandmother, obviously, and all my family back generations. And one of my favorite things was hog maw, and that's what it was called, hog maw, which is the lining of the pig's stomach. And it just acts like a gigantic casing.
That's probably kind of weird for some people.
Well, that's why I brought it up. I mean, when I was a little girl, in the first grade or whatever, and I'm talking to my school friends about how I had hog maw at my grandma's house when I went to visit on vacation, those kids, I mean,
sounds good to me.
I think I lost some popularity. They were like, oh, this person's kind of weird. And I mean, to me, that was perfectly normal. I mean, it was the way I was raised. And it was truly one of my favorite. Well, and of course, I mean, you stuff it with good pork, sausage, and potatoes. And it, like I said, basically what it does is it just becomes a gigantic casing.
It's a Pennsylvania Dutch porchetta.
And the really fun thing is that the pork casing or the hog maw itself becomes, you keep basting it while it roasts in the oven, and oh my gosh, it becomes just sort of mahogany colored and it gets crispy and just rich and just, oh my gosh, that was always my favorite part. I didn't care when I was little. I didn't care about the sausage and the potatoes. I really, really liked the outside, the casing. Yeah, the hog maw. So,
the thing that's along those same lines is if you're of Scottish descent, and I have a little bit of that blood. And I was taken the first time to a St. Andrew's Society meeting by, I guess, my uncle, Tom Jameson, who was 100% Scot. Mm-hmm. And I did not, however, wear a kilt at that meeting.
Oh, I would like
he
to see
and,
that.
He and 40 other men did.
I love kilts. And, I think they look great.
I love plaid. I'm wearing a Czech shirt right now. You just can't see it on the radio. So Tom takes me, and these guys, cocktail time, aperitif time for these guys is line up a bunch of bottles of whiskey and knock some back. So they're they're pretty calm, and their taste buds might be a little bit less sensitive than maybe at some other meal times.
Yes.
And the centerpiece of the meal was, of course, haggis.
Of course.
Which is the stuffed sheep stomach.
I really
want lamb.
I want to have that prepared it can by be fantastic. Somebody that is good at it.
It can be fantastic.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
I've never had it.
It's just fresh oatmeal and a lot and liver from the lamb and some of the meat. It's a force meat basically.
Sure.
That's heavy on the oatmeal, seasoned with whiskey and sea salt. That goes in the sheep stomach.
Okay.
And yeah, and you
same deal.
And you roast it in the oven, mm-hmm. and the stomach on the lamb is really strong. It's not so interesting to eat. Stuffing is amazing.
Okay.
The stuffing is just amazing. It's sort of like the best mincemeat pie you could ever have.
Yeah, and I grew up on that, so I get it. Yeah,
but that accompanied by, now, if you have the great big strong malt whiskeys, the lamb stomach, no problem. That becomes no problem at all. But I think I was 16 when I went to it, and was not allowed to be served, and I found it to be kind of strong. I think the most exotic thing I had before that was, sort of farm cooking, normal stuff, my great-grandmother, and maybe spanakopita from Greek friends of my mom.
Gosh, I love that. When my mom used to cook calf's liver when I was a kid. That was a little too much for me. One, it was one of those things that I couldn't stand the way the house smelled when she was making it. And she was really, she and my father would eat it. And that was one of the few things. I mean, obviously, I grew up the way where you were, like most people of our generation, where you had to eat everything on your plate and you had to take everything.
The Clean Plates Club.
Oh, yep. Gosh. And oh, my gosh. I mean, that was one of the few things that she did not make us eat, which I was really, really thankful for, because I would not have been able to stomach that.
I loved calf's liver as a kid.
That's unbelievable.
Loved it.
Wow.
I don't know if I was iron deficient or something like that.
But your body was like, you have to have this.
My great-grandmother would cook it in bacon fat.
At least that's a good way to cook it.
There was a very fancy fresh restaurant that my grandmother took me to when she saw that I had an interest in the business and I was doing a lot of cooking here in town. She took me there. I actually met Mark Dottori there for the first time.
That's amazing.
When I was probably 16 years old, 17
That's so
years
cool.
old.
What was the restaurant called?
Stall 1043, I want to say.
It was a French restaurant?
Yeah.
Huh.
And in South Baltimore. And
I've never heard.
A very small place. It was the place before the conservatory.
Okay.
And the special was calf's liver with raspberries and raspberry vinegar.
Wow. Well, that seems...
And it was very different from the bacon fat. Yeah. But I had that, and it was great.
That's one way to...
The new wine innovation...
Spiff up the calf's liver.
Wait for this. The new wine innovation at that moment in time.
Oh.
The hot new thing.
Oh, wait.
My grandmother...
What year was this?
Loved. Do the math. You're talking about 1981.
Oh, okay.
The hot new thing was white Zinfandel. White Zinfandel. And boy, she loved that.
Oh, boy. Yes. Dodo would have loved white Zinfandel.
Little bit.
I can see that.
Sweet pink wine. You got it. She insisted that I sneak a little bit for...
She's so cool.
To
she
have
was
with
so
my liver.
Cool. She was a wonderful lady.
But yeah, I love that stuff.
That's funny. All right. Calf's liver with raspberry and raspberry vinegar. Right on.
Yeah.
Probably deglaze the pan with the vinegar.
Yeah, I would expect so.
Yummy.
But it was literally just the pan sauce.
Yeah,
and
when I was a kid, I couldn't
fresh raspberries and...
So the other thing is sweetbreads, and that is not weird
that's
to
not
me,
weird.
But I think that's one of those things that
it's an old-fashioned thing to cook.
Yeah, it should be clarified because a lot of people just have no sense of what they are.
Well, people are terrified of sweetbreads,
but they don't know what they are.
They used to come into the restaurant and ask you if it was the brain.
Yeah, and like no,
it's not the brain. it can kind of look like it before it's cooked.
But not really, but yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, well,
it is unusual looking.
And it can be soft.
Yeah, it is soft.
Which also...
When it's raw, it is soft.
Scares people. There's not a whole lot of, you know...
Well, and you're not going to make it at home, I mean, unless you're really a good cook, because it's a process. You have to purge them first, so they have to go into ice water or in a sink with running cold water over them. And if you're going to purge them in ice water, just do it overnight. And then you poach them in a court bouillon, which is white wine, water, carrot, celery tops, you know, a little bay leaf, peppercorn. And you make your court bouillon first. You cook it for at least 20 minutes before you put any food in there. And then we typically poach our sweetbreads for about 6 minutes. And after they're poached, we shock them to stop the cooking process. So they go into an ice bath. And then we drain them and then we press them. So we put them in a pan with another pan and heavy things, like we used number 10 cans of tomato paste, actually, to put on top so that weighs the pan down on top so they become nice and solid. And then we can slice them thin. You have to pull the membrane off the outside, which isn't hard. I mean, none of it is hard. It's just a lot of effort, and you have to have a sense of what you're doing. You really should read up on it. And then we slice them. And then we serve them. We almost always grill them now. I used to sauté them. And that would be dust with flour and sauteed in corn oil with a little salt until they're golden, and then add whatever you're going to add to it. Instead, we grill them. So we lightly dust them with flour, salt, and grill them. We oil the grill down very well before we lay them on. We don't actually oil the sweetbread, which is a very unusual way to cook something. The oil has to be hot and, you know, pretty good on the grill so it doesn't stick. And then as it turns, we baste it with oil, and it becomes crispy on the outside and almost creamy on the inside. That might be deceiving to say creamy, but it's tender on the inside. That might be a better way of saying it. And that's just, they're incredible. And there's so many things you can serve with them.
Unless you're thinking that it's brains.
Brains, which they're not.
Which I was always happy to eat, too.
So it's the thymus gland and the veal calf. So it's a gland in the neck. That's what it is. So it's not brains.
So when we come back on WYPR, it'll be a bit more on the weirdest stuff you ever cooked. And maybe a little bit of the best food and wine pairings you ever had.
Oh, I like
the
that.
The best matches. Mm-hmm. I think people are pretty interested in what great matches are. Mm-hmm. And then when we get to the third segment, you're going to suffer under Chef's Challenge.
Jeez. I'm up to the task, Tony.
Anyway, this is Foreman Wolf on Food & Wine on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
When we last left off, Cindy, I was giving you the business over sweetbreads, but what this program really is about is all the weirdest things you ever had to cook and or you really want. What is the weird thing you wanted to cook that you haven't had a chance to yet?
Ortolan.
Ortolan?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've eaten those in Spain, too.
Yeah.
I didn't cook them,
that would definitely be my holy grail. But
you know they're illegal, right?
Yeah, that's the problem. So that's why. Never will.
They're legal in Spain, too, but two winemakers showed up with them at another restaurant just outside of León, and this guy opened them up, seasoned them, closed them up, you know, whole birds, mm-hmm. feathers and everything, mm-hmm. and they went in, wrapped up in foil, went into the embers of the fire, and after we'd had tapas for, you know, an hour and a half, and wine for an hour and a half, then pulled them out, and then basically peeled them.
Oh, my gosh.
And then finished them in a pan. And they're all nice and smoky. And
I bet that was incredible.
It was, imagine milder quail. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't quite have the livery taste of quail. I mean, there's a reason that they're highly prized.
Sure.
And flavor was pretty amazing on those guys. And it was super simple preparation. But ay, ay, ay. With a big Rioja, that was great.
I also have I have this thing because we, on the farm, we collect so many twigs and things, sticks, and we have a gigantic pile of them. And the man that works my property has been burning, when it's allowed, for a long time. It's a big place where it would be perfect, and we have a good amount of downed things, so it's a pretty huge pile. And I want to cook in there. I want to get that going, and I want to put birds in the the embers and do that. That's what I want to do. I'm dying to do that, and I would like to do the Argentine.
Well, I told you this summer that Mary and I will come out.
I would love to do that.
I think, don't you have that charity event?
I do.
Yeah, we were going to come out to do that with you, right?
That would be fun. I really would like to do it.
I don't know how much I'm going to enjoy having a shovel in my hands too much, but
we can do that part.
Yeah, we have to dig the pit, mm-hmm. you know, build a fire, got to brick it in a little bit.
It would be fun.
You know, and I think we have a spare plancha top, so.
Yeah, that would be, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what Marcelo used to do.
Because you cook on it for hours. It's not, you know, we were talking about doing a tasting menu with just meats. Because why? Because you just keep cooking on it. You just keep cooking on it and drinking wine. And cooking on it and drinking wine.
You could put some potatoes in there. It doesn't have to just be meat.
It's if you're Argentine, it's probably meat. And
a big batch of chimichurri.
Well, it's meat or it's organs.
Yeah.
It's beef or it's
peppers,
lamb,
sausages.
There may be some token vegetables in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Marcelo only used to put peppers on the grill.
Yeah, there's not a lot of other stuff.
With the whole pig.
That's okay.
5 gallons of chimichurri in the cavity.
That's okay.
Oh, boy, was that good.
So food and wine pairings. What were your favorite, you know, this is not like what you haven't had yet that you want to have, but what have you had that you were surprised by, stunned by? I mean, I know some of the things on my list, but what's been on your list? Because wine is like listening to music for me is tasting wine. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a memory for that. That's strong.
Certainly do.
But for you, it's maybe a little bit more like what is a song that was catchy that, you know. So, what wine with a dish changed that you're excited about?
I think the realization that you can have champagne throughout an entire meal was one of the biggest experiences for me. That champagne can stand up to, you know, first course through entree.
That can function all the way through.
Yeah, and so that's not being specific.
Depending upon the wine.
Right. It's not being specific, but it's that experience that I will not ever forget and I greatly appreciate because I love champagne so much. But I think, to be specific, some of the Rayas, Pegos, some of the other great Chardonnays, La Vieille Julien, just eating at La Bourgaviere and having truffle dishes with some of those wines. And I mean, I've always enjoyed the experiences of having different winemakers through the same vintage and in the same region. I just think that's fascinating. It just it tells the story of the terroir as well as it tells the story of the harvest and the year. And how did each winemaker deal with the difficulties of a growing season and the wonderful aspects of a growing season? And what was the result with their, and especially in Chateauneuf, because, you know, they have these certain grape varietals they can work with. And, you know, just seeing how they blend those varietals or what percentage of those varietals are in the wine, as well as what they ended up producing for that particular season. I just think that's fascinating. And so, you know, so many of those wines are obviously so very perfect for the cooking of that region. Obviously, these things make sense. That's why the cooking is the way it is and the wine is the way it is, because the things go hand in hand.
Well, things grow up over time together so that you would expect them to function best with each other.
Mm-hmm. And
that's one of the earliest things that, you know, I remember hearing from a chef. If they grow together, they go together.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's perfectly making sense. And I think also sort of having something like unusual that we wouldn't have had in the United States prior to having it in France, having the foie gras en cocotte cooked, you know, slowly in a tremendous copper pot with all this broth and some vegetables and having the particular wine. And I don't remember, that was so long ago. I don't remember what that wine was. You had the dish, but I got to taste it. And I just remember thinking, okay, that Chateauneuf is shockingly good for that particular dish. And to have foie gras cooked that way, because I was at that point so used to either searing it and, you know, hot on the outside to a cool center and then it goes onto a plate with a garnish, or having the terrine of foie gras. But having the foie gras cooked in the broth for that period
having
of time,
yeah,
it was a very different experience for me.
The texture is super decadent somehow.
Yeah, and I think Marcoux also comes to mind. I mean, I think that those particular wines just are so perfect for that regional cooking.
For the Provençal.
Mm-hmm.
Not the coastal, but sort of the poor Provençal cooking.
Yeah, minus
I agree with that.
Minus
it's,
the truffles.
It's, they're pretty guttural wines, but have a lot of joy in the, and same thing about the cooking. I get that. Having champagne sequenced, I felt like last time we were in France with the work guys, the meal that we had at that very good little one star.
My gosh.
The sequence of wines that we had with the courses, it was going from a soprano to a tenor to a baritone with those wines and with those courses too. I mean, all those steps went together. I mean, to some extent, music is always a connection for me between, is a great metaphor for wine. What I think of when you were mentioning Rayas and Pego, the great producers in Chateauneuf-du-Pape, what I think of immediately is, well, they're great singers, right? And sometimes when you have someone taking over an estate, well, the voice changes a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a student of a particular singer that becomes great, but it's still not the exact same voice. Chateau Rayas, Jacques Reynaud, who is the great winemaker there for so long, when he passed away, his nephew, Emmanuel, took over. He's very talented, but it took him a while to find his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, the wines have been fantastic, but not exactly the same as his uncle.
Sure.
The song, the actual, what they work with, you know, that to me, that's the terroir. That's the place where they grow the wine, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then people say, well, what's the vintage mean? Well, the vintage is a little bit, imagine hearing a symphony in a field versus hearing a symphony in a concert hall versus hearing a symphony, or maybe it's a string quartet. Maybe it's those to me maybe sort of reflect how tremendous a vintage is or not, mm-hmm. how long it will. You know, I think those musical metaphors are probably the best ones to sort of try to understand that.
What are some of your favorite?
I think the first time someone told me that Sauterne and Roquefort or blue cheese was going to be great, I was like, that's disgusting. That's just the nastiest thing I ever heard. First off, Sauterne is this incredibly sweet dessert wine from Bordeaux, and it smells like honey and wildflowers and especially when it has a lot of botrytis, the noble rot with it. And it has this deep golden color and has this unctuous texture and there's oak, so there's a bit of vanilla decadence to it. And it has great acidity from the grapes that are in there, the Semillon, the Sauvignon Blanc. But you think it's dessert. You think it's like vanilla custard and blue cheese. I don't want blue cheese in my vanilla custard, right? Mm-hmm. However, this is speaking to functionality versus flavors. So you think flavor-wise, that's going to be gnarly, right? Blue cheese is always fatty cheese, right? It's usually Roquefort or sheep's milk cheese. So it's fatty. It's strong. It has this essentially spice because mm-hmm. the blue mold functions like spice with it. It has strong salt. And so it's leaving fat
and
salt.
And it's acidic.
Yeah, it's leaving fat and salt and acid and that strong, spicy flavor. What the heck other wine is actually going to carry it?
That's for sure.
You know, it's the overkill that matches the overkill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The sweet is what handles that strong flavor and handles that fatty texture, that, you know, the unctuosity of the, I hate using words like that, that you make up on the spot, but that ridiculously rich texture that the Roquefort has. But then the salt needs the acid, and you need it to clean up on the palate. So it actually makes the Sauterne not seem terribly sweet because it functions so well with it. And the Sauterne and the Roquefort seems more mild because it functions so well together.
Yeah.
And they change each other entirely. But the first time someone told me they were good together, I thought that was the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Well, you immediately, I know this isn't wine, but you immediately made me think of when we were in Italy and the winemaker Primo gave us the amazingly aged piece of Reggiano and gave us that old, sweet balsamico.
The 50-year-old balsamico.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, that was just, I couldn't believe we were going to do that. And I'm like, oh, this is like the best thing ever.
Yeah, you freaked out about that.
It was really good. So, yes, balance.
I will never forget that meal because he asked us if he wanted to kill a baby.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So he.
I don't understand.
So Primo.
It was a young wine?
The winemaker and the owner of Nino Franco, right? The great Prosecco producer. And he was going to tour us to the winery. We go to his house. He takes us to the winery and he asks me, we're standing there in the cellar, so would you like to kill a baby? With his big smile on his face.
Now,
Primo didn't speak a lot
of
English.
He said that in Italian.
So we're going back and forth between.
Okay.
No, he said that in English.
Oh, I don't remember hearing that.
He said
that
in English. He was talking to me about wine. So I think it was just meant for me. But I will never forget that because I'm like, I'm just meeting for the first time. I don't know what kind of weird stuff you're into. And that's really not my bag.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm like, Primo.
Really?
Is that meant for me? You know, is that like. Like, I don't know which way to take this. He's like, a baby wine. You know, very young wine, great wine. It's like, that's really the best answer you could possibly give me.
Oh, my gosh.
So we go to the winery. We go to his stash in the winery, and he pulls out a bottle of 2003 Chateau Cheval Blanc, which is very, very young at the time. Mm. And we took that back to have with lunch.
Yeah, okay.
You know, And it's funny, I had 1997 Salvioni that I bought at the wine shop in Montalcino, was a wine I was, you know, completely after and just wild for. And so we'd had Prosecco with first things.
Yeah.
And then we had those two red wines with lunch, the Riso and everything that we had then. It was a risotto with peas.
Yeah, that was so good. I got to stand in the kitchen with her when she was making that.
Yeah, it was great.
Oh, that was a beautiful.
But the two wines were very just to be shown off with that. And what we discovered was that the new oak on the Cheval Blanc was too much, and the wine was not congruous. So, anyway, when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll spend a little bit more time on weird food and great matches, and a lot more time on a chef's challenge. I'll get the Kleenex out for you. On WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
I'm Chef Cindy Wolf.
So we're talking about all the strangest stuff that you ever had to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And also some of the most fantastic food and wine matches, and casually sort of dubbed this the murder program because we've talked too much about little animals being killed to cook them.
I want to hear another one of your favorites since you're the wine guy.
As far as matches?
Yeah.
I mean, easy great matches, champagne and oysters. That's an easy, easy great match. Especially a Blanc de Blanc champagne where it's all Chardonnay and really bright and lacy thin and long, minerally, almost like lace, with some kind of mineral shadow to it. One of the most surprising ones, years ago going to a great sushi restaurant, trying to figure out what wine for sushi. And everything that came to mind, I kind of brought, I put in a carrier. And I brought with. It was with a little group. And all of these things were all kinds of crazy, supposed to be impressive things. And I thought Alsace wine would work. We thought the Chablis might work. We thought that maybe really light Pinot might work. That maybe Champagne would work. And none of them were as successful at all as Condrieu. The white wine from Viognier, where it's this exotic, plump, bright, flowery white that's very low acidity, and the alcohol is kind of high. And, man, that was just fantastic, especially if it was a little spicier or a little saltier with sushi, whether it's rolls or sashimi. It was incredibly good, and it just smoked everything else. It just crushed it. So that's probably the most surprising one that I think people should just grab.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some things... There is a bifurcation in your choice. If you're having a burger and you want to have a reasonably priced red wine for your burger, do you want to go the fruity route, where it's like having jam on your burger? It's kind of like, are you ketchup or are you mustard? The ketchup route is like Red Zinfandel or Australian Shiraz or maybe a really fruity Malbec. That's one way where the wines have a lot of sucrosity. The other way, the mustard route, is a red wine that has really sharp acidity. So Chianti Classico, or even like Chianti Fiorentini, or Colli Senesi or something like that, where it's just sharp, medium-bodied, that kind of thing. That to me, or a Côte d'Or Village would seem that way if it's not from a really big ripe year. But that's kind of, that's what occurs to me is,
for hamburger.
I mean, if you're trying to do like a burger and it's a great match, you got to pick ketchup or mustard.
Got it.
You got to pick Zinfandel or Chianti Classico. those are the matches to me.
Okay.
Now you make me want sushi though. You ready for your sushi challenge?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you just thought about that for a second. All right.
No, I didn't.
It's not a sushi challenge, but there is a complication.
What's the complication? Only on your grill?
Only a grill works.
All right, that's fine.
No oven, no range.
As usual, we're on the same page. That's funny. Zucchini, cabbage, carrots. What's that word? Onion?
Zucchini, cabbage,
carrots. Does it say cinnamon?
Carrots. Cumin.
Cumin.
I know that you don't speak cumin, but
yes,
cumin
I do.
Still remains a dry
All right,
spice.
Clam, slam shoulder. Wow. Basil, arugula, sheep's milk, thyme, sweet white turnips, a little greens. And their greens.
Yeah.
Garlic, shallot, and onion, extra virgin olive oil, and all dairy. Only your grill. Only your grill.
I don't know what dairy you're going to grill, but
I don't either. I'm like, what do I need dairy for?
I just kind of put it there to tease you. I mean, you have a work table.
Sweet white turnips.
You have a knife.
Oh, well, that comes in handy. I'm going to crush the garlic with a little bit of salt and smash it on a cutting board with extra virgin olive oil, sort of just seeping in and out. And I'm going to run my hand down the board and push that right into a bowl. A little bit of freshly cracked black pepper, finely chopped shallot, and a little bit of finely chopped onion. And the turnip, I'm going to brunoise, which is the smallest of dice. I'm going to also do that and add that to it. They're greens. I'm going to wash those super well, and I'm going to julienne those greens, and I'm going to toss that in too. So that just became the accompaniment for the lamb shoulder. I do like cumin, no matter what Tony says.
The turnip is going to be raw?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Basically, that was a turnip relish. Turnip, garlic, shallot, and onion relish. And it's going to be...
Seed white turnips, you could probably get away with that if you used a lot of salt and a little vinegar.
Are you doubting me?
I'm not downing you.
What are you talking
about? I'm just I love turnips. I'm just thinking about how to do that.
What is wrong
with you? I think you probably need a little bit of vinegar in there. That's all.
Oh, whatever.
And then, I didn't give you any vinegar. You can borrow some vinegar.
Yeah, you didn't give me any. I'm trying to work with the list you gave me. Isn't that the way this game is played? Lamb shoulder is rubbed with a small amount of cumin and extra virgin olive oil. Again, we don't cook with extra virgin olive oil, but it sure is going to impart some good flavor into that. So you don't need much cumin. Is it whole cumin or seeds?
Your preference.
Ground cumin. So heavy salt and pepper on that lamb shoulder. Got to do that probably at least overnight. Let it work in. And, carrots and cabbage. So the lamb shoulder grills, I'm going to sort of get it started where it gets nice and charred on the outside. Not too charred, but a little bit. And then turn the heat down very low and just let it slowly grill. And I'm going to make a little salad with basil, the arugula, and a little bit of the cabbage. And again, I'm going to julienne the cabbage. And so now we have the salad, which is going to get the sheep's milk tome, which I'm actually going to grate some of the sheep's milk onto it. That's a great thing about that piece of cheese. It's grateable. And
firm sheep's milk cheese from the southwest of France.
Right. And so that's going to be my salad, the basil, the arugula, and the sheep's milk. And the cabbage. And then the zucchini and the carrots, I'm going to, what in the world can you do to a carrot on a grill? They're going to have to be very...
I think you're going to find out.
Right, very thinly sliced, apparently. And we do ribbons of zucchini, so I like to do that. Actually, wash the zucchini really well and pop it on an Asian mandolin, so you're just doing long slices, the lengthwise, basically the length of the zucchini, as long as they're not too big.
Luxurious zucchini slices.
Luxurious, sexy, silky, beautiful. And that gets rubbed with oil, corn oil, neutral oil, salt and pepper, and that gets grilled and it cooks really quickly, probably 30 seconds. The carrots I'll do the same thing with. It's going to be a little odd, but I'm going to do oil, salt, and pepper, and I'm going to put a little bit of the cumin on the carrots as well and just kind of pop those on and mix the two things together, and that will be the vegetable accompaniment. And the clams, that will happen during the cooking before anything goes on the grill, and I'll just steam them open on the grill. That'll be fun. Actually, I've never done that, and I think that would be great. Just serve it maybe with a little bit of the garlic, shallot, and onion before it gets mixed with the turnip and a little extra virgin olive oil. There you go. Enjoy.
Sounds good.
There's yours. Read the top. Luke and I worked on this before you got here.
I bet.
Mm-hmm.
I bet. Teaming up. Yeah. I'm not scared. Father's Day grilling. Okay. I thought it said farrier. So, no, Father's Day grilling. Whole chicken. Beer in a can. For the cook. Yukon Gold potato, white vinegar, zucchini, basil, extra virgin olive oil, corn oil, whole grain mustard, bacon, pantry spices, tomato, heirloom tomatoes, you mean, Napa cabbage, eggs, lemon. Let's see. I've not grilled eggs. So, I do love eggs and bacon salads. That's one thing for sure. It really makes me want to make a dressing. Do you give me any greens? Napa cabbage. Yeah, what I really want to do is an eggs and bacon salad. So get that bacon nice and crispy. Cook the eggs, but don't overcook the eggs in really nice salted water with a little vinegar in there, not poaching, just boiling them in the shell.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have slices of that, slices of the tomato, ready to go as a garnish. But I'd like tossing the egg and the bacon chopped up in with the cabbage. Make the dressing a little bit vinegary, for sure. You don't want the olive oil. It's too strong of a flavor. It'd be nice to have a little garlic. Do you have any garlic?
Sure.
It's on the list? Okay. You're easy. And you want to make a vinaigrette. You save one egg to make the proper vinaigrette and make a lemon and Dijon. Whole grain. Can I trade the whole grain for regular Dijon? Yeah, it's a little spicier, that's all. The whole grain's always a little sweet.
And it's fine.
That's great. Drink the can of beer. You want to grill thin potato slices. And then the whole chicken, if it's Father's Day grilling, I break it down into pieces. So you have chicken on the bone. You're going to have to save the rest of the carcass for stock. And it says pantry spices. Rubbing that down with black pepper, dried thyme, lots of salt, and some of the extra virgin olive oil, and a tiny little bit of that vinegar. And you really, it's not just rub it down, but you're going to give it almost like a salt massage with all those seasonings. And if you can let it rise a couple of degrees from out of the fridge before you put it on the grill, it's going to make a big difference in how well that penetrates too.
For sure.
And then you want to grill the pieces on there. And then if you can, drop that temperature down on the grill. Put those potato slices on there. And if you have a little bit of garlic, maybe you have to use dried garlic because you only gave me pantry spices. But a little bit of that and plenty of salt.
Yes.
And grill those slices.
Okay.
And then you kind of have these warm grilled potato shingles to go with the nice, well-seasoned,
okay.
beautifully cooked pieces.
I can't wait to tell you this.
Yeah?
So Luke thought for sure you knew about chicken in a beer can. So I'm like, I don't think Tony knows about chicken in a beer can.
I know about chicken in a beer can. I just don't like it.
So that's why he gave you chicken in a beer can. And then we had to, I'm like, you have to show me this. So he showed me on the internet.
Just because I have knowledge doesn't mean I like it.
The first instruction is that you open the can of beer and you take several large gulps out of the can. I'm like, oh my gosh.
I follow the first direction.
And then you're supposed to put the chicken on the can of beer and then put that on the grill. I'm like,
I understand that.
I have never heard of that.
I would rather season it really well and cook it really beautifully.
Oh, I'm not being critical.
And just drink the beer.
I just thought it was funny. I've never heard of that.
And then go inside and get a big bottle of Puy-Puy-Say from the 2014 vintage, which is great. Make that a little colder than I would drink it inside and drink that with the chicken and the potatoes.
I would rather have your version
and salad
than chicken grilled on a
half can of
beer.
I'm not sharing any beer with Luke because he'll just put a chicken on it. Anyway.
Oh, I'm so glad you didn't know what that was.
I knew what it was. I just don't like it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's why your ingredients were chicken and beer in a can.
Yeah, I kind of figured. Just because I have knowledge of something,
it does not mean
I have to do it.
No, for sure.
I know how to drive a car off the road. I don't have to do it. I can stay on the road.
I want people to write in and say if they've ever done this. I mean, obviously people
have.
So
it's ForemanWolf at WYPR.org. Have you had a beer while you were making chicken?
No. Have you grilled a chicken in a beer can?
Have you grilled a chicken in
a beer can? Half full.
Have you?
Not I. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, I see.
That was a new one for me.
Yeah. New to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Luke, our producer. Thanks,
Well,
Luke.
And somebody on the internet.
I'm sure that many, many people like this. I'd rather give the chicken a really lovely massage and then grill it.
Oh, that was fun.
What is the most garlicky thing you've ever eaten?
Wow.
Because I know you get upset when there's too much garlic.
Oh, boy.
you'll have a memory like getting into a car crash.
What bothers me the most is when garlic is burned, because that's just cooking garlic at high heat just really ruins it. I love garlic, but I don't like too much of it, and I don't like it when it's burned.
Don't put fat in the pan.
Oh, that's gross.
See, they don't put enough fat in the pan, and then they put the garlic in there, and then they have a conversation and drink half a glass of wine, and they look over.
And it's brown.
And the garlic is,
and it's really bitter.
Yeah.
I know I've had, somewhere desperately hungry for some, you know, was lost in the woods somewhere and had to eat a Caesar salad that had just way too much garlic, raw, horrible. Or I also can't stand garlic powder. I'll never forget one time my sous chef bought garlic powder, and I walked into the pantry, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And I threw it away. And I think they dug it out of the trash after I left. But I'm like, no, it wasn't for our cooking. It was for employee meal. It was the only reason they would have ever bought it. And I cannot stand garlic
powder.
What
terrible stuff would they subject the staff to?
Awful. I don't know, but something with garlic powder in it, apparently. But yes, that was Carson, actually.
Well,
yeah, you know.
God love him, but that wasn't a good choice. It's funny that you talking about this reminds me of, and garlic I like. I mean, I like it to be appropriately used.
I like it too.
But I like it.
Yeah, it just has to be worked with correctly. Like pretty much everything.
So, yeah, I'm completely starved. I'm going to meeting after meeting after meeting. I've got to drive between things. There's meeting after meeting after meeting. And then I have that moment that I have way too often where it's like, oh my God, I haven't eaten anything.
I have to eat something, right.
I have to eat something. So I run into a place and they have all of these great looking pizzas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's one that has these fantastic slices of tomato. It's like, oh my God. You guys sell pizza by the slice? Absolutely. Can I get two of that one? Absolutely. Now me, I'm not a genius. I didn't bother to ask what was on there. Well, garlic, it pretty much is the same color as melted cheese, right?
Oh my gosh.
Okay. So this was the most garlicky thing I've ever had. And it was pretty close to raw. So I'm like everyone else in America. I go run into my car with two hot slices of pizza.
You're all excited.
I'm excited. And I'm like, oh, my God, I have to eat. Thank you, Lord, for food. And I go to bite into it. I'm like, what is that? Oh, my God. Ho, ho. So, and you don't want to go back in because you feel like a dummy.
Right.
You want to go back in and say, hey, I'm not going to be like, I reject your pizza. So I waited. I waited about 10 minutes. I waited and I waited. And I went back in and I said, you know, that was so good.
Oh, you did not.
I was so good. I'd like to try something different.
Oh.
So tell me what's what. Just because I'm a dummy doesn't mean I can't learn.
Do you have any more garlic pizza that I could avoid?
Yeah. Just in case there's anything else toxic on any of the other pizzas, I'd like to know what's on everything. And then I had two very nice slices of pepperoni pizza. Which really,
I feel like all I've done is laugh during this entire. funny.
I'm a very funny guy.
So. You are funny looking. I mean, funny. Yes.
Thank you for that. So, well, that's all we have time for on Foreman & Wolf on WIPR. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And if you wish to reach us on social media, Chef Cindy Wolf is.
You can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf and on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
I'm sparsely on there as the real Tony Foreman. I'm not quite the photographer you are on Instagram.
Thank you, Tony.
And if you want to download this episode or any others, please go to the WIPR website, WIPR.org, and look for the Foreman & Wolf page, and you can look on the whole menu. Thanks so much for listening.
And have a great Sunday.